Hello and welcome to Hey Kids Comics number 40, another fine edition of Hey Kids Comics, and the fourth chapter in From Funny Books to Graphic Fiction, Turning Points and Changing Tastes. As you may know by now, Andrew is still on hiatus this week, and so we have with us Bobby Blakey, former subject of one of our actual issues of Hey Kids Comics. Bobby!
Hello, sir!
Greetings, and thank you for taking up the coveted surrogate Andrew spot for the week.
Well, not a problem. I figured if he can do it, anyone can.
Wow.
He's not here to defend himself.
Well, that, and it's kind of role reversal. It's sort of like Rodney Dangerfield in Caddyshack, where you're kind of taking the opposite role that you're accustomed to being in.
Yeah, I usually take the beating, so now I'm going to dish it
I
out.
I know. Good for you. And you'll never be invited back. So, moving forward, this is, as you know, we're also kind of exploring a brief history of comics without being really a history lesson. No chalkboards, no giant dusty tomes full of poorly selected, highlighted passages. Instead, we're going to talk about kind of how comics have evolved and some of the history of going from the concept of funny books, quite literally, into the point where there was a pogo cartoon, which apparently at some point, I think the 90s, somebody decided that they needed to get really retro and start publishing pogo again. Because the anthropomorphic denizens of some swamplands that had not been drained to build a mall needed to be explored again. And there was one strip, which I doubt I'll be able to isolate to use as flavor art for this, but if I can, I will, where there was like a fox or somebody trying to sell some of the younger critters of the swamp some comic books, and they were decrying them as juvenile and not really worth their attentions. At which time he, being a clever fox, switches gears and offers them some graphic fiction, to which they they immediately gravitate toward.
That's like the comparison of calling a sacker at a grocery store a courtesy clerk.
Exactly.
you try to make them sound more important by changing the name when they still do the same damn thing.
Exactly. And I think what was really wonderful about that is for those of us who were, you know, the adult collectors of comics, it really spoke to where comics had gone from, you know, I think I said on the first issue of this story arc that my dad actually referred to them as funny books one time that, you know, it was a very cringeworthy thing to say to a collector.
Yeah, I had kind of the same issues. My dad always would be like, why are you wasting all your money on that nonsense? You know, and what was funny is, and I didn't remember it in detail as much as still, you know, my mom would remind me as I got older, but when they got married, my dad had a drawer full of comics that she had just given away. I think he was hostile because she had given them out to all the neighborhood kids, and because she didn't think he needed them because they're for kids, you know. And then, of course, here I come doing it, and he's like, what's this crap?
So essentially, he was just trying to protect you from potential marital strife down the line.
That or sheer depression from getting rid of your stuff.
Yeah, but he just wanted to, like, by God, this will never happen to my son. I'll shame him out of collecting comics so he'll never know the pain of having someone give them away.
That, and I think he even went the overboard route, too, is I shouldn't draw them either because it's a waste of
time. I think most people would agree.
Yeah, well, not just my art, but in general.
Oh, in general.
Yeah, that was before that I was as the hack that I am today. But it just seemed like he would never admit it, but I honestly think that there was some truth in what you just said. I think not necessarily about the strife of marriage, but yeah. I think he was actually kind of hostile about losing that part of his youth.
Yeah.
Because he still dug it. You know, he would pick up some of mine every so often, and we'd have the argument about folding the pages all the way back, you know. By the time I was collecting.
That's one of the great sacrileges of collecting.
Yeah, but every comic back in the day, you know, if you read it, they put them in the back pocket, all that kind of stuff. You know, by the time I'm holding it dainty, and he's like, what's wrong with you? What are you, a girl?
We talked about that very thing on a recent episode.
That's funny.
You know, rolling the comic out and stick it in your pocket, or just tossed them into an old paper grocery bag until you had enough to go trade with your friends.
Right, exactly.
And you would read the thing till it fell. You would literally was like, you know, anthropological exploration of the Library of Alexandria or something. You just had to meticulously hold all the pages together.
That's funny. That's one of those things I never under the time of these coming out. I mean, I can see it now because there's such a more of a focus on collecting. But back in the day, you know, at those times when the Supermans and the Amazing Fantasy 15s and all those were coming out, nobody was collecting per se for the most part. People were reading them.
Exactly.
So when you bring a comic that old to somebody and they're like, oh, it has creases. Well, no crap.
Yeah. People, you know, people actually bothered to read them.
Yeah, and I was like, to me, you know, if it's still intact, then I don't know why it would affect the value. If it's torn in half, I get it. But,
yeah.
You know, for them to say, well, there's a small crease here and it's got a little bit of rolling to the edge. I'm like, well, what did you think I did with it? I was 10.
Exactly. You know? We didn't care back then. And, you know, that's a good jumping off point for this week's topic. Is turning points where we began to see the comic industry reacting to a lot of different pressures, and one of those was a burgeoning collector market.
Yeah, I remember as it's come up, you know, I'm in that realm. You know, I probably didn't get heavily collecting till the late 80s, early 90s.
So you jumped in just in time for that.
Yeah, like just, you know, I was really late, really getting into coming into it, but I know that it was a market like even up till now. From then till now, it's grown to the point where it was like you said, funny books, it's kid stuff. Now you have to struggle to find the kid book.
That's so very true, and that's another point that we'll be bringing up a little later in the show is about. That struggle to find the happy medium between the adult and child audiences. But one of the big key turning points that gets a little lost in the shuffle is that point where, you know, there was a, we've talked about on the show before, where the publishers would gleefully talk about some new species of paper.
Right.
That they had developed that would, you know, tortoise paper that would outlive its owner. The old newsprint was out.
Yeah.
And they were looking for papers that would last an eternity, that were indigestible to silverfish, that in...
Right, in the coming nuclear apocalypse.
Yeah, they would outlast. They were sort of the Twinkie of paper. And, you know, was this necessary? Because what it also did was, yes, it's going to preserve your lovely comic. It will look just as crisp and beautiful today, and you can't pick it up with silly putty. But it's going to cost you.
Yeah.
And that's where a lot of the pricing glut came in. And then the other glut that began to emerge at this point was, I think, you know, I can't say this with certainty, but I really think that as the 24-hour news cycle began to emerge in this country, the comics as an investment began to emerge in this country.
Right.
Because it got to be bigger and bigger news. There were a handful of really high-profile auctions of what were actually high-profile books. And it was the kind of thing that in a previous age would have been remanded to some little blurb in the deep recesses of the Sunday paper, that, you know, a Detective Comics of some vintage had sold for $1 million.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, once that becomes prevalent, once that becomes sort of the filler, the sawdust that the 24-hour news cycle uses to pad itself out, then it put those sort of things in a much higher profile. It created an illusion that people bought into wholeheartedly. And so suddenly, books that used to, you know, have a reasonable print run were selling out and going into second printings. And, you know, during the mid-80s and early 90s, second printings were running rampant, and that was unheard of. I mean, you really had to be something to get a second printing.
Well, I think that came into the you know, that was their other way of capitalizing and be able to do their new covers. They found a market because they knew people were going to buy them, you know, and it clearly, you know, in my personal opinion, and I know probably a lot of the older school people think that way, you know, I think comics lost something when it lost newsprint. You know, the creativity for a long time, I know it's not as much now because there's so many fresh stuff going on, but for a long time to me, it felt like it became a business and no longer people that love to create comics.
That's a good insight there, is that it really, a lot of things were lost in that period. And that's a really good point that you bring up, because for the most part, there became editorial dictates went rampant. And suddenly, you know, everything had to answer to marketability.
Right.
And post-market sale. And as we often talked about on Hey Kids Comics, the advent of writing toward a trade paperback.
Oh, yes. Well, it seemed like everything they did then, it started becoming, you know, how can we make more money? How can we push this one book, forget the entire series, that you create some new villains and some new story arcs and stuff to draw people in. It's like, how can we take issue number one and create 30 copies of it and make a bunch of money off of it, and but still make it like we're not ripping you off, we're giving you something.
That's great, too. We're not ripping you off.
Yeah, because it's like how many issue ones could you really own and get anything out of it other than look at the cover? You know, I mean, and I was guilty of it, just like anybody else at bottom. I was like, ooh, the Jim Lee cover, ooh, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Then, you know, Jack Kirby came out of retirement and did a cover, oh my gosh, you know.
Yeah,
and then you find out
like,
it was artwork,
you know,
he had done 20 years ago.
I think a lot of people, it got so outrageous that, you know, someone would come out of retirement, like, you know, Jim Lee comes out of retirement to do this cover. And it's sort of like the reality is that, you know, people are – the reality is, it's like, hey, Jim Lee, here's some money. You want to do a cover? Sure. You know,
well, yeah, it's Michael like Jordan retiring for the
a few hours out of my busy day.
Right.
Because, some of these guys are just so amazingly talented. I'm not trying to undersell them here. Some of these guys are just so amazingly talented that they literally, you know, you say, well, hey, Alex Cross, can you do, I didn't even tell you, and you're already done.
Right.
Because that's how good they are. But, you know, I think the perception, it's like those things you see on Facebook all the time, you know, what I do, what my parents think I do, et cetera.
Yeah.
And I think there became this sort of perception that, like, you know, Jim Lee comes out of retirement and people are imagining Stan Lee getting in a helicopter and flying out to some remote area in Montana and approaching this cabin replete with booby traps and
right.
having to parlay for an audience with Jim Lee and talk him into... You know, only for you, Commander, and then he comes back.
As opposed to him stop drawing whatever he's drawing.
Yeah, exactly. You could take a few minutes away from that. Could you do this cover for us?
Right.
So, yeah, there was very much a big monetary push. And, you know, the most outrageous, of course, was Gen 13, number 13.
Oh, that was amazing. What are you talking about?
With 13 covers.
And I will have to admit, I believe that I have all 13.
I bet you got one of the blank ones and drew yourself a drawing.
I don't think I did. I think I was too lazy.
Really? I'm amazed. Because I was going to say, I could see you drawing on the blank cover as long as it wasn't like Fairchild or...
you had to go there, didn't you?
Yes, your inability drawing or females lack again. Of desire to draw the female form.
I have actually never drawn on the cover of a comic book. Any of those sketch covers, I know they're really popular. My whole problem is I'm still in the mentality of you don't mess up a comic, and I can't bring myself to draw on it.
You will not be a sin eater of collecting.
That's right. I'm like, I will not be the guy, you know, that wrote his name inside the comic. I ain't writing my name on the cover either. I don't care why I'm doing it.
You don't want to destroy that pristine artwork.
Exactly.
Of which there is none. Though, actually, I think on that particular blank cover, they designed it to look like a comic sheet, a blue line.
Right.
With grunge kind of, you know, holding it at a jaunty angle.
I'm sure I looked at it and pondered it.
Yeah, and daring you.
But I think at that time, especially, I was I mean, I was super obsessed with the Image launch when it kicked off, like most everybody else was. But, I mean, I was so into it. I bought every Image title that came out. I didn't even care who did it. I was like, it's an Image book. I'll buy it. And, I mean, I even did my college English paper on the Image company.
Yeah, the nice thing about doing a lot of college papers or doing college papers for a lot of fanboys was very often there was such a disconnect in knowledge about a lot of the things that fans just love.
Right.
That you could write about them and get away with it in the sense that, your college professor probably had not clue one.
I think he might have been a comic fan, but I know he was so impressed with my whole production of what we did. You know, it was a group effort. We were supposed to have three of us. I told the two girls that had partners, I was like, you just sit down, I'll do all this. I went home and put the whole thing. I brought comics. I brought in, put the whole thing about it coming together. I brought copies of every single issue as well as the Image Zero so I could show what they were giving away. And I did, you know, and I, at that time I'd already had it autographed by like four of the guys, and I was bringing it up and I did the entire presentation. He's looking at me like I was a god. It's like, this guy knows everything about comics. And ironically enough, I actually, that was around the same time The Death of Superman came out.
Oh, yes.
And I was working at a comic book store, and I bought a whole bunch. You know, they were like $2.50 a piece, I believe it was. And I bought, I think, 10 of them myself, because I was keeping a couple for myself, because, you know, you had to have one in the bag, you had to have one open read.
Oh, yeah. Well, that particular one was legendary in that...
until it became completely worthless.
Yeah, now it's not worth the paper it's printed on.
But I sold one of them. I sold six of them at college, ranging from $5 to $10 each, including one to my professor.
So really what that was just a commercial.
It was. Like, look, I know comics. You want to buy something?
The interesting thing with that was, and I may have talked about it here, it was probably more likely back on Amazing Comicast, about when we were working for Diamond and gave a copy of that issue to our UPS driver. We had one UPS driver we really loved. He was great. And then we had the little guy, the little man, who everybody hated. But luckily, the little man didn't come on that day, where we had a billion cases go out. I think they had to bring in another truck that particular day. But we gave him one, and he was pretty sure he could get laid because he had that.
That is a powerful book.
That is. And, you know, the Death of Superman brings up another point about this that falls into the purview of Gen 13 at this period, where you're beginning to make a shift from comics as entertainment to comics as business, as big business. And, you know, the Death of Superman, the Jim Lee X-Men number one, which at the time I think it had 1 million copies or something like that.
Yeah, I think it's still up there as one of the top, if not still the top selling comic.
Yeah, I think they printed one. They actually celebrated the fact that they did 1 million copies. And, you know, those of us who were a little more forward thinking at the time said this shouldn't be a cause for celebration. This should be a cause for concern. Because what they're selling is the concept. You know, a lot of people bought 5 or 8 or, you know, a bunch of them. At that period where, you know, as we talked about on this one episode of the show, people thought they were going to put their kids through college on their comic collection.
Right.
Without realizing what made that Detective Comics, what made that Amazing Fantasy, those books that sold for fortunes so special, is the lack of volume that still exists. To own a comic book of which only 5 or 8 are known to exist in the world makes it valuable.
Right.
To own 10 copies of something that there were 1 million made and 900,000 of them are probably still in circulation, mostly in quarter bins today, is nothing.
Well, and seeing that, it affected a lot of the as I'm sure you know, the stores that were starting to sell them, the way they were running their businesses. The store I worked at the time, as a matter of fact, who ironically, this is probably no shock to you once I tell you, she's no longer in business. this lady had bought this store, and it was around all that same time, and the guy was fixing to hire me because I was a regular customer and knew stuff. He told her, said, hire this guy, he knows stuff. She knew nothing about comics.
That is a very good point that I've often brought up, is this was also a period where all you had to do was get a bank loan and hang out your shingle, and you could be moderately successful without having a clue.
Right. She was wanting to buy a music store and came across this guy selling the store. He's like, look, you know, I know you don't know a lot. I have this guy I was fixing to hire. He already knows everything you need to know. He comes in here. He knows all the customers. She hired me, and you know, I more or less showed her the ropes of how stuff worked. She still never read the books. I'm not even sure she ever read a book for the amount of time she had the store for years, but she started hoarding. She would get stuff, and there was an entire collection in the back room of, say, Superman, The Death of Superman. She would have 25 copies hoarded in the back, and then she would put them out. She'd put out the ones that came out for the week. She'd save the other ones for about a month, mark them up 10, 15 bucks, and then start selling them. You know, and we'd had regular customers that would come in and say, look, I missed this book. I didn't have it. Do you have any of them? I sold one the day it came out to a customer, a regular customer, one copy. I sold it for $15 the day it came out when everybody else still had them in the stores for $2.50. I told the guy, I said, I have this one copy that's hers. I can sell it to you for $15, thinking he wasn't going to buy it, so that way I didn't have to sell it and get in trouble for trying to sell it. He was like, yeah, I need it. So now I'm thinking I made an awesome profit. You know, she was mad because I broke her stockpile.
Yeah.
And I sold a book that was going to be worth millions. You know,
well,
and
yeah, you just squandered her $100 book for a mere $15.
Yeah, she still had tons of these books that stayed back there. So her millions that she was having was slowly becoming worthless because she held on them so long, they went up and went down all before she sold them.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that happened to a lot of people, and in a way that led to a crash in an industry that never should have existed in the way it did. And there are so many people who were retailers back then that are not, they're gone.
Right.
So, you know, essentially, that's one of the big problems with that period of changing taste. But there were some upsides to that, in a sense. And that's when more and more adults were coming into comic shops, especially those who'd never been in there. And, you know, for every, you know, out of 25 people who'd never set foot in a comic shop, maybe two or three of those 25 who came in as investor walked out as collector.
Right.
Or collector speculator. But at least they were bothering to, you know, crack the cover on this priceless gem that they just purchased. And I think a lot of new comic fans were born in this period.
And, well, you know, you mentioned, you know, the fact that having to go into the comic shop, I think with the way the industry changed the books themselves, like you were talking about earlier about how they made them, you know, the cost increase and everything else, I think that also affected the fact that you can no longer go to 7-Eleven and buy comics.
Oh, so absolutely.
You had to go to the stores to find them. So it became like, obviously, there must be something to this because you have to go to a special store to get them.
Exactly, yeah. And the rack jobber was slowly disappearing in favor of the direct market. By about the mid-80s, you could still find comics in a few places.
Right.
There was a legendary run of 7-Elevens trying to find Web of Spider-Man number one because we couldn't find it at our comic shops. That meant it had to be valuable.
Right.
They never ran out of anything. So what you started then also to see, when comics became big business, at least there were enough editorial decisions made to start to lean toward capturing that new adult audience. Now, early on, that was an occasional thing. You would get your Dark Knight Returns. Clearly not your father's Batman.
No. But an amazing Batman nonetheless.
Yeah, an amazing thing. I sort of stumbled into it because I went to a comic shop signing by Frank Miller. I had my copies of a couple of issues of Marvel Universe, so I could get Frank Miller to sign his drawing of Infinity.
Right.
And Daredevil and Elektra. And everybody, it was like going to, a costume party and being the only one out of costume.
Right.
I gave in to peer pressure because all the cool kids were there lined up with their Dark Knight. So I had to buy a copy of Dark Knight, which was like $9 or what.
Was that for the graphic novel?
No, it was like about they were square bound, so they were probably about $3 or $4.
Right.
An issue. And see, and I went ahead and ponied up for one of those and got it signed. And it was one of those things where, I sort of was shamed into buying in and then read the thing and followed it through all four issues.
See, I kind of had a similar situation. I wasn't shamed, but I haven't been shamed into doing a whole lot of things, I'll admit, on here. But I actually, ironically enough, one of the very first comics that I got into, it was two different Batman series kind of at the same time. As a friend of mine I was hanging out who was a big comic collector, and his mom, they would take him to comic stores. At this time, I didn't even know comic stores existed. I went to the convenience store or the little bookstore. It was kind of a half-price books type of thing, but it was like a mom-and-pop place that had a comic section. And I was buying just random stuff, but I wasn't really reading and collecting. I'd be like, ooh, this one's pretty, and that kind of thing.
There was a lot of that during that period, too. Image Comics is certainly testament to that.
But he at this point, The Dark Knight Returns had already come out, the full graphic novel. It was the first one, had the gold-looking buildings with the face, that was, I think, the first printing of the graphic novel. And he had gotten it, and he's like, dude, you got to check this out. And I'm like, I don't care about Batman, I want to watch the 60s show, And I remember reading this, and of course, I didn't really understand what was going on. I'm like, man, I must be out of it. I know nothing about Batman, apparently. And I was like, dude, I need to get caught up. Do you have any other Batman? Because I had no idea what's going on in this book. It made no sense. Because, everything I knew was from the 60s show or whatever. And he goes, yeah, read this. And then he gives me the miniseries, The Cult. The Batman Cult miniseries.
Oh, yes, Batman The Cult.
Bernie Wrightson did the art, I believe. Did he?
I believe you're right. Yes, absolutely right.
And I was like, this is the most amazing comic ever. I'm not supposed to see this. because both books were so adult.
Yeah.
And that was the day that I kind of not only got heavily into collecting as an ongoing reader of series, but I also realized these aren't just kid books. There's something more here.
And that's where you started to see a real shift. And what was interesting is you were seeing a shift very subtly happening in other mainstream books. Some of these things, like a lot of the Frank Miller stuff, was decidedly aimed at a more mature audience. Certain titles like Daredevil, especially under Miller, were starting to really grow up. And then you had titles like New Teen Titans, which skirted a wonderful, brilliantly walked both paths. They were very accessible, yet were beginning to kind of tweak at more mature themes.
Right.
With subject matter like Brother Blood or Raven's Lineage being the daughter of the demon Trigon, or the Runaways two-part story arc, which they very nearly ran without the Comic Code Authority seal.
Right.
If you listen to the last issue, or two issues ago, you'll know about the history of that particular icon of days gone by. And so you saw the mainstream kind of pushing toward what would later be largely remanded to miniseries, because it allowed there to be a maturity to a lot of books without it being directly connected. That way the entire universe didn't have to grow up simultaneously.
Right. And see, and that used to confuse me when I first got into it, because my first introduction, like I said, was to miniseries stuff. So when I was reading the books in connection to these miniseries, by the time I started getting into like regular books, you know, the Batmans or whatever, I'm like, why is he not, you know, only got one eye now, or what, you know, exactly. what happened? Why is he normal here? Or why does his suit look like this? And I was still trying to grasp that concept of these two totally different worlds that have nothing to do with each other. It just happens to have the same character.
Oh, exactly. And, you know, a great example, and I know that it seems like I beat a dead horse when I... It's become sort of a trademark of mine to mention Watchmen whenever possible.
As well you should.
Yes, absolutely. Because I will defend it being the single best work in the entire 100-plus year history of comics. It's the most concise thing ever written. And what's really important about it, in the context of these turning points, these changing tastes, and the way the industry was responding, is that Watchmen was commissioned back in the mid-80s when the Crisis on Infinite Earths was going on. And that was, you know, a one-year project. It was an attempt by DC that kept very much to its mainstream roots, but it was, they were trying to bring in all their different universes, all these different things where they, you know, they pretty much won the Captain Marvel family in a lawsuit decades before.
Right.
They had acquired the Charlton Comics catalog and therefore now had Captain Atom and Blue Beetle and, you know, a number of other characters.
Is that really a win, though?
You know, the thing about it is, if you look at the old Charlton stuff, which is just, you know, classic 60s comic fare.
Right.
And a lot of it was Steve Ditko, so, you know, a little surprise there. But if you take that, there, some of the characters are a little goofy.
No.
Yeah, but but after they consolidated their universes, the Blue Beetle comic early on was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And he fit very nicely into that universe. He worked very nicely in the DC universe. And then, of course, you know, once Booster Gold was created and somebody had the foresight to team them up and you know, turn it into one of those sort of Mel Gibson, Danny Glover, or... you know, Will Smith and whoever Will Smith was teamed up with lately.
Tommy Lee Jones.
Or Jackie Chan, what's his name, annoying guy that I can't stand.
Owen Wilson?
No, the annoying guy.
Chris Tucker?
Yeah, Chris Tucker.
The one you didn't want to say, the black guy?
No, I was going to say the guy that reminds you of the guy from Police Academy who does all the sound effects, only he only does...
Michael Winslow.
Yeah, only he only does one sound effect, which is really screechy. He does the, you know, fingernail
so
that draws the chalkboard.
So you're not a fan.
In the words of Peter Griffin, I am not a fan. But, you know, when they took those characters, some of which, you know, were kind of goofy, they took Captain Atom and almost immediately jump-started him. I think when they gave him his own title, it's like, okay, let's shed the nifty 50s costume and look, and let's make him a little more futuristic, a little more high-profile. They sexed him up in a big way. But before all of that, I mean, it was like Blue Beetle and Captain Atom were sort of the answer to what they thought they might be getting when they turned to Alan Moore to do something with these new characters. And the something he was going to do with them was going to leave most of them either altered, dead, or just unusable, especially within the Marvel Universe. And so, you know, if you've never made the connection that Night Owl is Blue Beetle and Dr. Manhattan is Captain Atom, etc., there it is, finally for you. You know, and what you got...
I was just thinking about that last night.
Yeah, what you got was a better product, because Night Owl, in the context of Watchmen, is a much better character than Blue Beetle would have been.
Right. Well, and it's also one of those things, too, that, like... admittedly, the first time I tried to read Watchmen, I hated it.
Okay, I'm going to have to ask you to leave the show.
Well, no, hold on. I'm gonna redeem myself. Hold on. I love it now.
Okay.
At the time
Welcome
I read it.
Welcome to Hey Kids Comics, Bobby.
No, at the time I read it, it confused me. And the reason it confused me is because I'm like, okay, I'm reading a DC comic. There's no DC characters in this book. What's going on? And I'm like, okay.
That makes sense. You know, where you're...
Yeah, and so I'm like, maybe I'm missing something. You know, maybe I don't know who some of these people are. You know, there's always characters you don't know about. And as I tried to read it, I'm like, okay, wait a minute. Where's all the superhero fighting? What's going on? And I didn't grasp what he was trying to do that was so brilliantly intelligent at the time, that he was trying to tell, you know, more of a real story with real characters that affected their lives and, you know, all this stuff that goes along with it. And I'm like, you know what? This isn't working. I need a superhero in tights swinging around.
And, you know, the funny thing is I remember reading an interview – back in the day where I believe it was either Alan Moore or Dave Gibbons, I think it was Moore, who said that what they were shooting for was to sort of put the superhero in the real world. And in the real world, it wouldn't just be business as usual with guys flying around with their legs spread a mile apart with their hands on their hips.
You know. Yeah, and I just didn't, you know, at the time, I didn't understand what they were trying to do. And it was actually years later that someone talked me into trying it again. And I'm like, look, I'm going to read it, but I'm going to hate it. You know, it was one of those.
I'll show you.
Yeah, it's like, I've read it. It's stupid. I don't know why. All you people are just, none of y'all know what you're talking about. You know, it's no Dark Knight, blah, 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 you know. And I remember sitting down to read it, and I still wasn't a huge fan at the time, but I remember getting it. I said, okay, I see why this works. I see what they're going for. And it wasn't until I finished reading it, and then I sat down and kind of pondered it more, you know, and then I went back. I remember reading it a couple more times over a few years, that it sunk in. I realized what they were trying to accomplish, what they really did, and how it was so much different, and why it was so brilliant. You know, it was just a maturity level of growing away from, you know, because around that time that by the time I got into all of it, you know, we were talking about the growth of it, is, you know, the comics took a big turn in where it was all about the art, not about the story.
Oh, yes, very much so. And so many people, like our fearless leader over at United States of Geekdom, we've talked to him at length about, you know, he was very much an image man.
Me too.
You know, when I first started getting into comics, I was all about Marvel. And it was Crisis on Infinite Earths, which, you know, here was... story craft at work instead of just simply, you know, words and pictures all being put together.
Right.
Especially if you juxtapose at that time, talk about the changing of taste, Secret Wars and Crisis on Infinite Earths, and you look at this, the story craft and the absolute absence thereof as you juxtapose the two. And then you did start to see at that point, you know, Watchmen, I really also think, is instrumental even more so than The Dark Knight. The Dark Knight was a trailblazer, but Watchmen opened the door.
Right.
Watchmen paved that trail.
Well, I honestly think without something like Watchmen, we wouldn't have had stuff like Batman Begins, the movie, and Dark Knight Returns, Dark Knight Rises and all that kind of stuff, because... It did, like you said, it opened the door and it made it okay for the superheroes to be in the real world.
Exactly, and that brought you things like the incredible Marvels, where, you know, Marvel got it right in a huge way by telling the story of the Marvel Universe through the eyes of an everyman and taking you down to street level.
Right.
And... it was the sort of story I'd always craved, is what is the Marvel Universe like for normal Joe?
Dangerous.
Yeah, very. And, you know, it combined concepts and plot lines with some of the best art that will ever be in comics. The, you know, the iconic image of Giant Man striding through Manhattan and... you know, all anybody gets to see is his big blue crotch.
As well, that's all you need to
see. Yeah, that's, you know, it just sort of puts you in the mind of that Harvey Birdman with Apache Chief. And
right.
Guy's covering his wife's eyes up as he, as he goes giant.
And, you know, I've thought about, it's funny you say that, because I've thought about that watching these movies, and I've always wondered why there wasn't more of those kind of jokes slapped in some of those movies involving giant characters. You know, and I'm like, really? But that's all you're going to see?
Yeah.
You know, it's even if it's a gigantic, like, monster.
Yeah, when you get to the point where it's worm's eye view,
yeah.
It's just all crotch.
It is. And I was like, how can you really be afraid? I don't know if I could, you know, being immature, I don't know if I could do anything but laugh. I would probably literally die with a smile on my face because they'd probably smash me as I'm laughing at their crotch.
Yeah, you'd be so busy laughing at their crotch, you wouldn't see their foot coming.
Exactly. That might be a new power to work out.
They could be. Sort of a Who Framed Roger Rabbit kind of power where you can force people to die laughing.
Exactly.
And then you had things like Kingdom Come that, you know, just matured the living daylights out of the DC characters and took them places you'd never have imagined. You know,
yeah,
except Batman, you pretty much expected anything Batman did.
Before that came out, actually, I think Kingdom Come was one of the turning points for me because, you know, I was never – I don't think I really – for the longest time I didn't have either of the big two, you know, preference. I would kind of randomly buy stuff. But I was definitely leaning more towards Marvel for the X-Men stuff, you know, and I even got into all the Spirit of Vengeance stuff and some of the Ghost Rider stuff and things like that back then. But as soon as Image came along, I had almost all but forgot Marvel and DC. Because I had shifted to Image, but I followed, like a lot of people, I followed the creators because I was fans of those guys, and I got into their characters. It was the Kingdom Come stuff that kind of put DC back on the map for me, because it said, okay, these guys can tell a story now. You know, it wasn't even just Alex Ross's art, which was amazing, but it was like, this is an intriguing story with characters I know.
Exactly, and one of the fun things was trying to figure out who was who.
Right.
You know, when
and I could be wrong, because I always mix this up, but isn't that the same series where when Superman and Shazam are fighting? And that's not in the series where he just keeps Shazamming him and blasting him
and
covers his mouth? That, I think that is one of the most brilliant moments in comic history.
That was incredibly poignant.
When he covers his mouth,
mm-hmm.
And I'm like, why hasn't somebody done that? I've been saying that ever since.
Exactly!
It's like, how did this not happen before? And they even did it on one of the animated things. I don't remember if it was in Justice League or if it was in the Shazam Superman or Shazam Black Adam short, but they did that where Superman covered his mouth.
There were so many visuals in that as well, because Marvel's wonderfully utilized Alex Ross.
Right.
But Alex Ross really came of his own in Kingdom Come, and there's one that I don't think I've ever cited on the show, but I'll often cite when talking about it, is there's the scene where the Flash notices Norman McKay through the ether. Because they sort of posit that Flash has reached this level in his evolution where he's everywhere simultaneously.
Right.
And what you see in front of you, if he's at a standstill, is just that part of him that's willed to be physical.
Right.
So it was kind of neat because it's very subtle because, you know, it's well established that Norman McKay is invisible to everybody. He's not there. He's like Scrooge. And all of a sudden in one of the panels, you see that Flash is kind of looking over to the side like, what's that? Like something's caught the corner of his eye. And they yanks him out, and it's Power Girl who just, you know, rage and fury is just on top of him, ready to clobber him. And Superman, what's brilliant about this is the image conveys the raw power in her arm, that, you know, that her muscles and her superpowers are all just poised. And you see this wonderful juxtaposition of a character you know that can, like, take a piece of coal and squeeze it into a diamond, and yet the tenderness with which he's holding her back.
Right.
Like, I don't even have to try.
Right. It's, you know, it's like the mentality of Superman when he thumps somebody to knock him out.
Yeah, it's like you've got the power of a freight train, and with the softest touch, I'm holding that back.
Well, that was one of those moments, too, in a lot of the stuff like that book. The realism factor gave the DC characters life that they never had.
Oh, exactly, yeah.
You know, because, like, the other thing, like, what I was really – and it took me a while to – I was kind of off-put at first, but, like, the Alex Ross's art – none of the characters are really muscular. They look like, I mean, they are, but, you know, even Superman, he's not the Arnold Schwarzenegger muscle Superman that you would imagine because of who he is. It looked like an average guy who was had mass to him, but he wasn't ripped. He wasn't cut
exactly,
up.
Yeah, exactly, because he didn't
in Batman, even in Batman, even, you know, in this is going to sound stupid, but I mean it in the serious way, he had the Adam West body look, where he had more muscle than Adam West, but he looked like I could be Batman.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, instead of, you know, Jean-Claude Van Damme built body as Batman, you know?
What it literally did was humanize them.
Exactly.
And, you know, we're getting to that point that Andrew is always eyeing the clock, so this is a good point to...
And Andrew ain't here.
That's right. Let's run 3 or 4 hours on this.
And before I get in trouble when people listen to you, I am aware that his name is not Shazam and that it's Captain Marvel.
Good. I didn't catch that because I'll use it interchangeably.
I've been calling him Shazam for so many years because that's what my son knows him as.
Well, I think a lot of people. DC actually refers to him more as Shazam.
Right, because that's
the public face, and then in private they'll call him Captain Marvel.
Right, because Marvel has a Captain Marvel, so now I subconsciously always call him Shazam, but. Anytime I do a drawing or talk about him, you're like, well, you know his name is not Shazam. I said, yes, I know. That's the word he yells. Get over yourself.
Yeah. And a lot of people don't realize that Captain Marvel, the Kree over at Marvel.
Right.
His nickname is Zazsham.
Yes, I read about that not long ago.
That's an old, it's a very demeaning term in Kree that he has to live down, but like when he was in grade school.
Of course,
and he just stuck.
And I'm sure it had nothing to do with them trying to bash each other.
No, nothing at all. Nothing at all.
Oh, anyway, I'm sorry.
You know, just not apocrypha on my part.
I started getting the hate mail about why would you have a guy that doesn't even know his name is not Shazam.
And that we would get any mail at all would be welcome.
Okay, well, I tried. Then
so thank
I do
you
think
for
that's his name.
That
Let the mail fly.
And we'll just forward those on to you. So this... You know, as comics mature, as this floodgate, as the way has been paved and the you have this superhighway of maturity, then suddenly the publishers are realizing, well, we've managed to maintain the old people. We've managed to maintain our aging audience and weather the storms of, you know, the art-heavy competition over at Image. And one of the things that I want to bring up real quick is that Dark Horse Comics was born into this world and held its own beautifully. You know, if you looked at pie charts of sales of the day, it was dominated. The pie mostly went to Marvel and DC. And then Image and Dark Horse held a sliver that represented like 4 or 5% of overall sales in a month. But when you compare that to the fact that the remaining like 8% of sales that was left after the rest of the pie had been served represented 100 publishers.
Right.
I mean, they didn't even bother to mention anybody else by name. That if those two companies got in, that was pretty remarkable. And Dark Horse took it a little bit different tack and just told a lot of really good, often very mature stories in very short form. They were sort of like the BBC of comics.
Right, it was all miniseries.
Yeah, they just they got in, they did what they wanted to do, and realized you can always go back and try again.
Well, see, I think they were smart, too, even to this day, where they have their Dark Horse Presents book, where they can test the waters.
Exactly. That was.
And then if nobody likes it, like, okay, well, we lost 4 or 5 pages of one book. We'll try it again next month.
That's
you know?
Right. And that was the only anthology, and it ran for over 100 issues.
I think it's still coming out.
Really? I didn't realize they still published that.
It's probably not the same.
I'm so out of the loop.
Yeah, I think they still, or they probably restarted it, because I know I see them every so often come out with new stuff in it.
Oh, nice.
But they may be coming out as like one-shots to introduce stuff.
That could be as well. And DC tried to do that years ago and failed miserably. I'm talking on the order of like 25, 30 years ago.
Right.
So
that was the other day.
At the point where we just like up-jumped everything, to get the adult audience. Suddenly the publishers are like, oh my God, we're doing this at the cost of a young audience. We're not attracting a new audience. And of course, then they're running scared against video games and computer and everything else. And, you know, that BS has been bandied about for years, yet the industry still survives. It still thrives.
It's because those people that they're worried about, they don't make any money.
Yeah,
so they don't have the money to buy it.
But the thing about it is, then you started trying to seek out a younger audience, and that got you things like The Ultimates. Because Spider-Man had been around since your dad was a little kid. So, you know, trying to associate with a Peter Parker who was a professor at Empire State University was a little difficult when this character was originally, its original appeal was, that could be me.
Right.
And so the Ultimates allowed them to literally jumpstart everything without actually jumpstarting anything. And then you also had things like trying to capture the really young audience. And with that, you had a lot of licensed titles. Looney Tunes and Sonic the Hedgehog. And Rick's favorite, My Little Pony. It's just a test.
I think that's the only thing
I want to see if Rick's actually listening.
That's one of the only things that kept, like, Bongo and all that going because of The Simpsons and...
Oh, yeah. That's another good point is, you know, Bongo came in at a great time because they had The Simpsons and later Futurama and stuff. And were also very successful. They challenged the Dark Horse Image model and managed to get in a little sliver of that pie to themselves. And then there was the often embarrassing attempt to capture the girl audience.
Which I never understood.
Yeah, and that's one of those things where, you know, everybody who has a decidedly male market tries to get the girls.
And you know what doesn't make sense about that is, to me, that's almost demeaning to girls.
Oh, exactly.
Because it's like, okay, you have all these female superheroes, and how do you think, how can these female superheroes not appeal to them to read a book just as much as my male superheroes?
Well, you know, so why do they need something really special? Good Wonder Woman be enough? Why do we have to have, like,
right,
like little,
I mean,
girl,
I mean,
stuff?
There was a documentary recently that proves that whole point about the whole Wonder Woman, whatever, that talks about how Wonder Woman herself had all this impact on women's right movement and all this stuff through all this time well before I was born, but suddenly it's not enough.
Exactly. And then, you know, you're also trying to capture a little girl audience.
Right.
Who had Barbie and My Little Mermaid and Rick's favorite, My Little Pony. Not My Little Mermaid, The Little Mermaid.
I was going to say let that happen because I clearly didn't read that book, so I wasn't going to argue that point.
Well, you know, I'm the same as you. I'm mindful of the hate mail.
from all the My Little Mermaid fans.
That's right. Well, My Little Mermaid was Disney hauled off and put out the Little Mermaid based on the Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale.
Oh, okay, I
and
got
that
you.
Ruined the toy company's chances of getting My Little Mermaid, a spinoff line with mermaids with brushable hair,
which Rick probably has the prototype.
Yeah, he probably does. Rick was the prototype.
Oh,
anyway,
wow.
And then DC had their Johnny DC line, which was an attempt to, like, you know, have a young audience. And then there was one of the more unusual girl comics. And I think that literally it was an attempt to bring back the romance comic. And there hadn't been romance comics since before I was born. And, you know, that's dating this way back.
I wasn't going to say anything.
Yeah. Under their Epic line, which was their, even back before the more mature comics were prevalent, back in the early 80s, Epic was launched as a place to put, like, sort of grittier sci-fi or more mature kind of heavy metal stuff. That was sort of the imprint where you would park things where the comic shop owner would know at a glance, sorry, kid, why don't you try Spider-Man? You know, six against Sirius, or six from Sirius, whatever the hell that was. Little bit out of your age range. So this was in 2003. This was back when Mrs. Jedi Cole and I actually had a shop that was open on the weekends for 2 years. This is back when we were heavy into retail comic industry. And I bought a few copies of this just because it seemed like, well, this is unusual enough. But literally not since about the 50s had you seen the romance comic. And they came out with this comic, this miniseries, five-issue series called Trouble. And I don't know, even just talking about it, you start to get this sort of feeling like you need to scratch.
Well, you know, you look at the covers of that. And they tried to do that whole romance novel cover, but with teenage girls on
it. Yeah, then it becomes like a Boynton ad. And,
but I find it amusing because you look back at like people that were involved in creating it, you know, and you have Joe Quesada, who, based on the concept, which to me would have thought it would have ended his career.
Exactly.
But then the series was written by Mark Miller.
Yes.
Which I'm like, really? The guy that did Kick-Ass did that? You know?
No.
Like, I almost don't want to read Kick-Ass or anything anymore because I don't know if I could look at the guy. You know? It's like.
And the frightening thing here is, the thing that really makes your skin crawl a little bit is it was sort of a retcon on Aunt May. It was sort of like the Elseworlds for Marvel. Or what if Aunt May was a complete trollop?
And explain to me how this appeals. If you're going to appeal to the younger audience, why would you take one of the oldest characters and make her a teenager? Why wouldn't you take a character like a Wonder Woman or something and say, let's go to her younger years and see her as your age? Why do I care about taking a 90-year-old woman and suddenly make her 17?
Yeah, and the thing about it, what's weird is it's supposed to be, it's sort of like it's supposed to be Aunt May, but it was written in 2003. Takes place in the 70s.
Which now she's at least 30.
Like, okay, yeah. It's like, man, she got old. She got ugly.
And now she's a whore.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that would make Aunt May, like, you know, 40-something when Peter's in his teens. So, you know, clearly it has that disconnect. And they never really go out and say, this is Aunt May. But, you know, the one chick's name is May, which nobody in the 70s was named May.
Right.
At all. And then her best friend, Mary. So I think the idea was it was supposed to, like, juxtapose a sort of Aunt May and Mary Jane.
Or it could be just the fact that Marvel didn't have any creative brain power and couldn't figure out other names.
Either, because, yeah, or Mark Millar just was.
Because that's, Mark Miller's like, I like Fantastic Four. I like Spider-Man.
Yeah, so. But apparently, you know, it's just like tramps a go-go. And the May character gets pregnant at like 17. And.
Oh, yeah, and then there's one of them that, like, it's something about the. She's telling her boyfriend, but he's sterile, and it's from her affair.
Yeah, it was just kind of creepy, weird, and it begged the question in retrospect. When I went to, actually, this is the one little bit of research I did, because it bugged me. I could not remember the name of the stupid comic, and I left Bobby waiting for like 5 hours in the green room while I meticulously dug, and I found images from this book, but I couldn't open the websites from which the images came so that I could remember the name of the stupid thing. Finally tracked down that it was Trouble. I start reading about it, and it just gets creepier, and I'm thinking, you know, was this an attempt to get a female audience? Because I can't find an audience for this.
I honestly think, in my personal opinion, without knowing anything that these people were thinking of, and I guarantee if you were to ask them, they would all pretend it never happened.
Yeah, this could be like the Star Wars holiday special for its creators.
Yeah, I think they were trying to shake things up. They were trying to do some shock and awe. Look what we can do. We're outside of the box. You know, we've created something else, and we're shaking things up a bit. And then when people were like, what the hell are you doing? They were like, oh, nothing. know?
Yeah, this,
it's only 5 issues. We can pretend it didn't happen after that.
Well, also it was Epic, so they had that same option.
Yeah, we're like, well, we shut down that company because, you know, it just wasn't delivering. You know, I forget all these major creators that were behind it that are now like titans in the industry of creating. It's like, how did you still have a job? If you had done that at you know, if you put out a regular novel of something like that and just totally ripped things apart and people are like, what is this crap? What, I don't understand what you're doing. They wouldn't have got a second novel.
Exactly. You know?
And the person would probably be working at a, you know, a KFC now. Not running Marvel.
Exactly.
I'm not trying to say any names, Quesada, but you know, and then you know, like Miller going on, you know, I don't. It's kind of hard to figure out when they say the concept is created. I really would like to see that pitch meeting, because like I interviewed Todd McFarlane, and to hear the stories of how hard it was to get ideas and stories to come across when you're already established. It amazes me I would love to be a fly on that windowsill to hear, you know, Quesada pitching this idea to the higher-ups in Marvel at the time and say, let's talk about teen pregnancy with Aunt May as a 17-year-old girl. And I'd be like, wouldn't you think they'd reach across the desk and slap him?
Well, you know, at the same time, it does beg the question, was the reality perhaps that this was foisted on them? You know, they weren't the ones pitching it. They were just sort of, okay, guys, come here. We've got a project for you.
Well, possibly. I mean, unless they just gave him the credit that he came up with it. You know, maybe they gave him something and then they created the concept, maybe. I guess
yeah.
We can give them the benefit of a doubt. Maybe that is why Quesada's in charge now and the people that okayed that are gone.
Exactly.
And he'll be like, they forced me to do it, man. I was trying to make the best of it.
It was all part of a leveraged means of... of, like, you know, taking over Marvel,
right.
Stewardship of Marvel.
It was Quesada comes out, he puts out his Ash book very quietly over in the corner.
Then he, right.
This slowly sweeps in and takes over and forgets Ash exists.
Well, I think on that unique note, we will go ahead and close up this issue. Bobby, thank you very much for making this. This was going to be one of the more challenging ones when this was conceived. And, you know, you have come and jumped into the middle of it with aplomb, and I really appreciate all the insights you brought. And, you know, it's like Fonzie trying to say the word wrong. I'm having a hard time, you know, praising you because after so many years of just, you know, complete smacking you down at every turn.
Well, you're welcome to go back to.
Oh, good. Well,
I'm sure,
you
know, once we get done with this,
I just didn't want to lose that.
No. It's going to go right back to it. And I'm sure, you know, between Rick's love of My Little Pony and Andrew's, you know, complaint that we've gone over an hour, that the bashing will begin again. And I'll go back to ignoring everyone, like, because all of you are beneath me anyway.
So that's how you get by.
Yeah, I know that. I was like, look at them.
How dare they? Well, excellent. Thank you very much. Thank you, everyone. As Andrew would say, probably better than I will, read, collect, and most of all, enjoy comics. Enjoy the history of comics. And, you know, take a moment to look back and reflect on where we've been and why you're getting the kind of comics you get today. And just say, thank goodness there isn't a Trouble 2 coming down the pike.